Well, great sex is all about pleasure. It's about feeling great. It's about feeling exhilarated. Kosher sex is all those things, but it's also about feeling united. It's about becoming one flesh with your loving partner, with your married spouse. Great sex is where you scream the deity's name during the act, and kosher sex is where you remember each other's name after the act. Great sex is sort of the end to a journey. It's about achieving a destination. It's about having a great time. Kosher sex is the beginning of a relationship. It makes you feel so close that you want to have more and more of each other. And so it's a starting point rather than a finishing point. I think also great sex is all about just the thrill of the moment. Kosher sex is about the integration of the two halves of one soul. Kosher sex involves certain recipes. It involves certain ingredients. It's about losing inhibition. It's about knowledge, coming to know your married partner in the strongest possible way through physical love. I mean, sex today is very, very inhibited. It's about people feeling very worried about their bodies. Are they pretty enough? Are they attractive enough? Kosher sex is about dismissing all of that and just being yourself, putting yourself on autopilot, feeling intensely good about the company you share in the most intimate human environment.
How is the Jewish community reacting? Are people uncomfortable with the rabbi getting a huge publicity around the world talking about sex?
Well, I think there's a certain measure of discomfort in Jewish quarters. Certainly, it's not that widespread, but there is vociferous hostility to the book in certain quarters. I would say it's not just Jewish. It's probably true in many traditional and religious communities. Rabbis and clerics today are supposed to be discussing prayer and charity and goodness. That's all very important. But unless religion can demonstrate its relevance to everyday life, it's going to continue to suffer terminal decline. So that architecture is still studied today because you can put up a building with it. And computing is studied because you can write a program. And finance is studied because you can support your family well. Why isn't religion studied? Why don't people go to the synagogue or to church any longer? Because even if you do go, what possible benefit do you get from it? Except, you know, you don't feel guilty because you're allowing the tradition to thrive and not die in your lifetime. But religion has got to go back to the time where it was and is the most highly developed science of human living. Religion is about the maximization of human potential. Once upon a time, religion was all about teaching you how to be a great father, a great husband, a great son, a great daughter, a great wife. And Judaism certainly has always given advice, going back to the Bible itself and 2,400 years to the Mishnah and 2,000 years to the Talmud, has given explicit advice about how to have a very passionate, very healthy sex life, because sex is the essence of a relationship. It takes the edge off the difficult areas of life. And if things work well in the bedroom, they will work very well in the living room as well.
If Judaism, a traditional teaching, is so open-minded about sex, of course, within the marriage, where does the myth of a hole in the sheet come from?
It's funny, everyone's asking me that question about the hole in the sheet. Actually, let me just clarify. Orthodox Jews do not have sex in the hole in the sheet. That's a very, very lenient position. Most commentators are of the opinion that you have to have sex in full body armor. And the ultra-Orthodox have to have sex through a hole in a wall while they're in two separate bedrooms. And the really, really religious, they have sex by email or by fax, and they never touch each other and never see each other. Now, clearly, I'm just being facetious and flippant about this question because I can't imagine it was anything but a strong anti-Semitic diatribe against Jews. If you really want to degrade an ethnic minority, you attack their sexual practices. That's why we have white racist propaganda about black men, refers usually to the size of their genitalia. And the way that anti-Semites tried to degrade Jewry was to say that they had very, very strange, ultimately inhibited sexual practices, so they invented this myth of the sheet with a hole in the middle. It's about as true as Jews having horns, but it's about as true as the protocols of the elders of Zion, Jews trying to control the international media and everything else. Having said that, now that we know Jews already control the banks and international finance and media, we're now trying to control sex as well through books like Kosher Sex.
So tell us what Judaism says about it. You said that it's a myth. It doesn't exist. It's anti-Semitism. But you see religious people and you always imagine that they don't touch each other. They're very modest in their behavior. What does the religion says about it?
I mean, that's absolute nonsense, these myths that are propagated in the name of Judaism. On the contrary, not only can you not have sex with a sheet in the hole in the middle, you are not allowed to even be clothed during sex, according to Jewish religious law, because the essence of sex is flesh pressed against flesh. The Bible says very beautifully, quote from Genesis chapter 2, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and leave his mother. He shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh. The essence of human sexuality is for a couple to be sewn together emotionally, so that even after they physically separate and they go their own separate ways the next morning, she goes to her job, he goes to his, they still feel as close as they did the night before because the threads of emotion remain. So sex is about feeling close. You can't wear any clothing. And this myth about people not touching each other and everything else, for goodness sake, sex in Judaism is very passionate. The reason why women are encouraged to dress modestly in the Jewish religion is not in order for men not to have bad thoughts. It's the exact opposite. It's so that when they undress, men will have bad thoughts. It's so that...
Never thought about it.
So that the erotic allure of the body will be so strong and so heightened and so passionate that when a wife undresses in front of her husband, he turns off the television and he puts away the newspaper and he can't help but react to the sight of her body.
From your book, I understand that the Jewish marriage contract, the ketubah, actually defines the husband's duty to satisfy his wife in a sexual manner. Is lousy sex would be a good reason to ask for a get, for a divorce?
Well, certainly the Talmud discusses women who are deprived of sex by their husbands, and absolutely it is grounds for divorce, and any Beth Din would grant a divorce. A wife who refuses to have sex with her husband, or a husband who refuses to have sex with his wife, is called in Hebrew a mored, which you know means a rebellious spouse. The end of sex in a marriage is a functional termination of the marital contract. In fact, the Bible says that a husband has three principal obligations to his wife: she'ira, kesuta, ve'ona, food, shelter, clothing, and sexual obligations. And when we say sexual obligations, we don't mean the slam, bam, thank you, ma'am variety, where it's just quick and it's all about him enjoying himself and doesn't care about his wife. On the contrary, what we mean by ona, conjugal responsibilities, is that a man is obligated to pleasure his wife. He's obligated to ensure that his wife has enjoyed the experience.
So now we established that Jewish men make better lovers.
Any man can be a great lover, Jewish or otherwise, so long as A, he believes in real love, and real love is where you get far greater enjoyment out of seeing your wife's enjoyment than focusing on yourself. For a man, I mean, a great lover is someone who's very focused, very patient. The Bible says, as I quoted earlier, that sex is a form of knowledge, and the meaning behind that is that animals have no problem in achieving sexual harmony. They have no problem with sexual chemistry. And it's always about ridding themselves of a hormonal or chemical buildup. For the humans, it's very different. We are the only mammals that have sex face-to-face, showing that it's a form of knowledge, it's a form of intimacy. Secondly, men and women have very different libidos. Men are like triangles. They get very interested very quickly in sex, and their interest is lost almost immediately. For women are more like circles, more like curves. It takes them a bit longer to get interested, but once there, they remain interested. So how could the two come together? They have to harmonize. The man has to slow down for the woman, and the woman has to try to accommodate the passionate needs of her husband as well. And this just shows that if they achieve a synchronicity, that they will have a fulfilling sex life. And if they don't achieve that synchronicity, they won't. So, again, we come back to the idea that sex is not about a performance, it's not about an action that is purely physical, it's more about, it's mental, it's psychological, it's emotional, and it's about being in step together.
If sex is so important within the marriage, won't it be sensible to try the partner beforehand to make sure the chemistry is there?
No, absolutely not. On the contrary, I totally and utterly disagree with people who make that comment, because sex is one of those areas in life that the better you try to become at it, the worse you end up being. Sure, I mean, if I'm in the Olympics, the more I train, the higher I can pole vault, or the further I can throw a discus. Sex is all about not performing. It's about allowing your instincts to take over. It's about putting yourself on autopilot. It's allowing the beast from within to overcome you, your passions to overcome you and overtake you, so that you're not premeditating your action.
But your assumption is that you put a male and a female together, it will work.
I believe that those men who argue that their wives aren't interested in sex and that they have different sexual chemistry and they're not sexually compatible, this is the ultimate cop-out excuse on the part of lazy men who rarely make their wives feel desirable and then complain that my wife's not interested in sex. They don't help them in the kitchen. They don't help them with the children. The wives are too tired, and later they complain, you see, we're sexually incompatible. I love sex and she hates it. Sure, you're a jerk. You make your wife feel that she's utterly undesirable. You give her little of your time. You don't pay attention to her when she speaks. You don't help her with the children. Then you complain why she's not interested in sex. Because she's not interested in you, because you don't make her feel like a princess. And the same thing can true be, of course, with a wife to a husband. If she puts her husband down, she makes him feel he's stupid. If she tells him how unsuccessful he is, how lazy he is, and later she expects him to be interested in sex, for goodness sake, sex is part of a holistic approach to romance and two people wanting to share time together. I totally dismiss the myth of sexual incompatibility. I believe that all beings, all humans, are above all else sexual beings. We all have a nascent, latent sexual fire, and the objective of our spouse is to bring that fire to the fore through great attention, great focus, romance, and love.
How can you convince the young generation, the young secular generation, give them a good reason besides scaring them from AIDS that they shouldn't have sex before marriage?
Well, the question becomes, how special is the wedding night going to be? If they already know everything about each other, how special is the marriage itself going to be? Why should they look forward to getting married? And the answer is they don't. It's just some sort of formal ceremony, a piece of paper. It's a legal institution. It's a legal formula. And it's not about being sewn together as one flesh. And the consummation of your previous disunity being removed, and suddenly you're one. Marriage today is laughed at by most people. It's not something people look forward to. There's 1 in 2 divorce rate. Sure, if people get married, it's because they've lived together and everything else, but for social reasons and legal reasons, and they want to have kids, and they don't want children to be illegitimate and all that. It's rarely that I want to marry you because I love you. I love you, and we'll live together. That's a great shame. I mean, ultimately, it's not good enough to love each other because you're still like two different cities who are ultimately, at best, connected by a river. But what we want is to be one city. Marriage is about orchestrating two halves together as one whole. There's a beautiful story about Rabbi Aryeh Levine, who was the chief rabbi of Jerusalem. And he once saw his best friend walking through a hospital at 3 a.m. in Jerusalem. And he said to his best friend, who looked perfectly healthy, "Why are you in the hospital in the middle of the night?" And his friend pointed to his wife, who was limping behind him. And he pointed to her foot and he said, "Our foot hurts. Not her lousy foot got me up in the middle of the night and I can't believe this wife of mine is just such a pain. Our foot hurts." What he was saying is, my wife's joys are my joys. My wife's pain is my pain. And there's a great beauty to that. And I think that's what marriage should be restored to instead of it being just a quasi-legal financial agreement.
How did you meet your wife?
I was a student here in Sydney, Australia, sent by the Lubavitcher Rebbe to help found a rabbinical college in Bondi. And my wife at the time was at a teacher seminary in New York City. But I met her parents through, we had a program of adult Jewish education. And they lent us their home to stage many of the lectures and seminars which we put on. And I became very close with their parents. So that when I finished my 2 years of duty in Australia and I went back to the United States, friends of their family called me up and said, "Look, you know the parents, you're friendly with them. They have a daughter your age. Why don't you take her out?" I took her out. And shortly thereafter, we got engaged. And
what is shortly? How many times? How did you date?
We dated for about 3.5 months, and then we got engaged. You have to remember, in religious circles, it's very easy to come to know each other quickly because you don't get physical. And since you don't get physical, things don't get confused.
You know, why physical sex, will touching, confuse you?
Well, think about it. When a couple get physical immediately, it conjures up such strong, powerful emotions that you can't really rationally evaluate whether the person you're dating is attractive to you, has common and shared interests with you. You focus far more on, you know, this feels fantastic and everything, but what do I really think about the person? I mean, the physical can either be a form of knowledge or it can be a form of confusion. And when the relationship hasn't had an opportunity to mature, I think conjuring up those emotions so quickly really will lead to confusion rather than clarity.
You've got 6 children. Do you help your wife? Do you have time to help your wife?
We're blessed with 6 children, thank God. I try my best to help my wife. I'm a rabbi. I try to help my wife insofar as get her as much help as possible. But I mean, in the book, I try to advocate, and we try to live by this ourselves to the best of our ability. I think husbands and wives should not put the children first always. They must, at many instances, they must always put them. They must put themselves first. They should go away a few times a year on weekends without the children. They should make a few nights a month that are reserved only for them to go out.
You're listening to the Hebrew program on SBS with Nitza Lowenstein, and we are talking to Rabbi Shmuley Boteach about his book, Kosher Sex. Rabbi Boteach, you said that sex is the most important thing in a marriage. What's about communication?
Communication is also essential, but I think communication is not as powerful. It cannot bring it. It doesn't bring in its wake these overwhelming positive emotions that sex does, and it doesn't make you feel intensely good and intensely close to each other. It's communication is what you have with best friends. Actually, it's quite sad that so many couples today aspire to nothing more than being best friends in marriage. It just shows the casual nature of today's relationships, how we no longer believe in excitement and in intensity. So communication is essential, but real communication actually evolves from physical closeness, from what the Bible calls true knowledge.
So what is your remedy?
To creating passion in marriage.
Yes.
Well, there's a number of things that my book, Kosher Sex, seeks to point out. The first is that people should really try to keep Tarat HaMishpacha. People should try to keep the period of sexual abstinence in marriage, where a couple separates for 12 days out of every month so that the sexual steam can build up. so that they lust and hunger for each other instead of growing bored and weary of each other, and so that they're also afforded 2 weeks of communication and verbal dialogue, you know, followed by 2 weeks of physical closeness, 2 weeks of physical intimacy and passion. I think we all have to recognize that what we want most in a relationship is a bit of a contradiction. We want love, but we also want friendship. We want to be lovers, we want to be best friends. We want to love like fire, which thrives on novelty, excitement, newness. We also want to love like water, which thrives on predictability, routine, sameness. In the Bible, it says, have 2 weeks of each. Have 2 weeks of passion, have 2 weeks of friendship. And you should proceed along those lines. And instead of trying to proceed forward always, amalgamating both, which for most people is not possible.
You said also you should have sex 4 times a week. How did you reach that?
That was actually an invention on the part of a journalist, but hell, it sounds good. Why not? But the Talmud says that a man who is a man of leisure, and most people today are people of leisure. Sure, we work hard and everything, but we don't have the kind of backbreaking labor that peasants out in the fields had hundreds of years ago. A man of leisure is supposed to have sex with his wife at every available opportunity. But remember that since Jewish couples and people who follow this biblical advice don't have sex for the 5 days of menstruation and 7 days thereafter, so it affords you approximately 2.5 weeks a month. But in those 2.5 weeks, you should have great, pleasurable sex constantly. Why not? Sex is a beautiful thing, and it does make you feel closer. There's other ways to bring passion in marriage. I advocate that jealousy should be used at times. Often husbands begin to feel bored of their wives. And it's not because their wives are unattractive. It's not because their wives are not beautiful. We see in places like Hollywood, movie stars who are married to the most beautiful women in the world and later cheat on them. Is it because their wives weren't attractive? Of course not. It was rather that they grew bored of them. None of us wear the same clothes every day. We don't eat the same cuisine every day.
But we live with the same men.
True. Well, we try to change that as well. And we need a bit of newness and variety. So we don't want newness and variety in marriage, which means infidelity, which means, you know, new flesh. That's not fair, because we also want intimacy. We also don't want to hurt the person that we love and we're married to. And to cheat on them is the ultimate form of pain. It makes them feel redundant. It makes them feel like they can be easily replaced. It makes them feel like they're not special. The solution in many cases is to have some other man who suddenly looks at your wife and sees that she's beautiful. It's to be reminded through his eyes and his stares that of the woman in your wife. You know, the word mistress has this great erotic allure to it. The word wife seems to have this connotation of plainness. We can make our wives into our mistresses. In my other book, The Jewish Guide to Adultery, I sought to identify the 10 essential ingredients to a successful adulterous affair. And foremost among them was separation and renewal. Statistics show that men who abandon their wives to live with their mistresses, 87% of the time, if a man leaves his wife and moves in with his mistress, he ends up breaking up with the mistress within the first year. And that's because when she was unavailable and he had to steal time to be with her, it was all secretive. It was exciting. She's always available. It grew boring. So marriages should also have this cycle of separation and renewal. And that's what the Bible meant by not being available to each other sexually through every day of the month.
That's interesting. You said about excitement in the marriage. In your book, you say that prostitution and pornography, it's deaden our interest in sex. But we know that the industry is booming.
Is booming, but sex is dead. On the contrary, the industry has replaced sex. It hasn't enhanced it. It hasn't heightened it. It has supplanted it. Sex is dead in the bedroom. Statistics show in the United States that married couples today are having sex twice a week and 3 minutes at a time, for goodness sake. That's 6 minutes of sex a week. And when you think that men supposedly think of sex 6 times an hour, or some even say 6 times a second, there's a hell of a lot more sexual thinking going on than sexual practice. On the contrary, what pornography has done is deaden our interest in sex. Pornography is a very, very small kingdom which is easily mastered. How much of the body can you already be interested in? All these pornographic films that have no plot, that are sexually explicit, they don't heighten our interest in sex. They give us a quick thrill, and we are bored almost instantaneously. And the great proof to this is, if you look at all the films today, they don't have very erotic, steamy sex scenes. On the contrary, we're bored of them. So too much sex, too much flesh doesn't interest us. It bores us.
So you said we should keep the excitement within the marriage and try different things within the marriage, in our sexual life.
Yeah, first of all,
oral sex.
I think that there should be no inhibition between a married couple. Outside, the place for modesty and the place for inhibition is outside the marital bedroom. There, modesty is a great thing. It means that A, you preserve the sanctity of your marriage. It means B, that you preserve the erotic allure of your body by not exposing it. But once you get into the bedroom and it's time for sex, throw caution to the wind. I think for Jews, certainly, there's 3 great sexual sins. One is, you know, adultery, of course, which is a great sexual sin. Second is we don't have sex for 5 days of menstruation and 7 days thereafter. Third, we don't think about other people while having sex with our partner, which is also a grave sin. It's like mental decapitation. you cut your wife's head off and you basically use her body for friction. That is a grave insult. And any woman whose husband's head is on planet Zog while they're having sex is well aware of it.
They call it fantasies in the book. Fantasies.
I think fantasies are fantastic. Fantasize about your wife. Fantasize about your husband. Don't fantasize about somebody else. That's a sin, and it's an insult. It shouldn't be practiced. But as far as inhibition in the bedroom, it just doesn't belong there. You're a married couple, throw caution to the wind. And that's why the lights should be off. You shouldn't just focus on the body. I believe that sex should be done in the dark. Don't focus on sexual parts, on bodily parts. You know, just let yourself go. And that means you shouldn't be inhibited. Turn the lights off.
Why in the bedroom, on the marital bed, with the lights off? That part I don't understand.
Because sex can either be about the total personality or it can be only about the body. The body is meant to be the what pulls us to each other. But it is not what will keep us interested in each other. We get bored of the body quickly. So the body, if we take the metaphor of fishing, the body is the bait, but the hook is the personality. Sex should be about the orchestration of two personalities. It's about making love to a person, not just to a body, making love holistically. With the lights on, the body becomes opaque. We can't even see the soul. We can't experience the personality. With the lights off, we're making to a person in their totality, in their entirety. And that's the beauty of sex with the lights off. It's just about hearing sounds. It's about sensations. It's about fantasy. It gives room for the mind to roam in the sexual repertoire as well. It gives room for our mind to be an active participant. I mean, our principal sexual organ is our minds and not our genitalia.
Is sex the solution to everything? You say that sex should be used to mend arguments. Only later should those arguments be discussed and solved.
I think sex should be used to mend arguments because sex takes the edge off arguments. Women don't like that. They would much rather talk a problem through. Men want to kiss and make up. I think both sexes are right. I believe first kiss and make up, get the edge off the argument. And once you feel closer to each other, then talk the problem through. But don't talk about it when you're strangers to each other. Don't talk about it when you're going to just increase friction, increase heat, and really anger each other.
But how can you get intimate if you had an argument before?
That's a very good question. So the way I deal with that in the book is I say, if a woman feels very distant from her husband because he's just been mean to her and he's yelled at her or he's been very critical and he wants to kiss and make up, should she submit? Only if he apologizes. If he apologizes, accept the apology, kiss and make up, have great sex if that's what it leads to, and then talk the problem through. But to talk it through when you're hostile, when you're frigid, when you're hurt, is like pouring petrol on a fire. It's just going to make the problem worse. But when you've made each other feel really good and now you're calm, then she should come to him and say, look, I love you and I feel really close to you, but there's something that's bothering me and I'd really appreciate it if we could just discuss this for 5 minutes and just get it out of the way so we can go back to feeling really warm and close.
You touched on gay sex. What's the Jewish religion's attitude towards gay sex?
Look, the Bible is absolutely clear about gay sex. It's a sin. And I don't want to sound like a religious prude in saying that. The essence of heterosexual sex, that a man and a woman love each other, is the coming together of opposites. There were many ancient systems of belief that said that men come from one god, Zeus, and women come from another god, Aphrodite. Today we call it men are from Mars, women are from Venus. There's this belief that men and women are like so different, they don't come from the same origin. The fact that men and women can fall in love, have great sex, and ultimately produce life together is the ultimate demonstration of the divine unity, that there's one God who is the source of all life. And the proof is that people as different as men and women can still fall in love and create life together, creating this amazing equation of 1 + 1 = 1. That's what heterosexuality is all about. The problem, I think, biblically with gay sex is it's about sameness. It's not the same demonstration of the coming together of opposites. In Judaism, if a gay man comes to me and says, look, what can I do? I was born this way. I can't do anything about it. I've tried, but I'm not going to be heterosexual. I have no interest in women. I say to him, okay, I'll tell you what. If you're going to continue in a homosexual relationship, we will treat that like someone who drives on the Sabbath, or someone like smokes a cigarette on the Sabbath, someone that eats non-kosher food. It's a sin, but get on with your life. There's 611 commandments left to you. You can still give charity. You can pray. You can go to synagogue. You can read the Torah. You can study. You can honor your parents. So don't get hung up on that alone. It's a sin, but let's move on. We won't make you feel like you're an outcast, is what I'm saying.
I like it that you said frequent sex with the same partner improves your health. What's behind that statement?
Because sex is good for health anyway. Sex with the same partner not only improves our physical health, which sex would do anyway, it improves our psychological health. It makes us feel, wow, I'm really special to this person, and they really care about me. And even if the whole world doesn't think I'm wonderful or special, and if I die tomorrow, God forbid, President Clinton may not call a press conference, and they may not have, there may not be all the world's leaders coming to my funeral, but there'll be one person who'll be devastated, and the one person who'll never forget me because I'm the center of their universe. It's wonderful to feel that. all of us want to be not just loved in life. Our parents make us feel loved. And yet at the age of 13 or 14, it's not enough for us anymore, the love of our parents. What we want above all else in life is to be chosen. We want to be chosen by someone who doesn't feel compelled to choose us. Our parents are born. And when we're born, our parents love us intuitively, automatically, genetically. So when your mother tells you, you're the prettiest girl in the whole class, your response is, sure, mom, right. But when a guy tells you that, you say, it must be true, because he had no compulsion to say it. It must be that I'm really special. We don't need 30,000 people screaming our name in a stadium to feel special and unique, but we do need one person. And that's why sex with one person, feeling really close to one person, makes us feel like we're God. Every human being is created in the image of God. It makes us feel like we're the one and only. Because to this person, we are the one and only. They can't live without us.
Rabbi Shmulik Boteach, thank you very much.